So Brent and Lorna have joined us as well. Welcome. Tonight's sutta is on the, or tonight's class is on the Jambali Sutta, subtitled the wastewater pool. And this follows last week's class from the Pamadavaharan Sutta on refined or right mindfulness, mindfulness as the Buddha taught mindfulness, which followed our class on the importance of jhana meditation. And so this is a sutta that's uses metaphor almost throughout. The whole point of using those these descriptive metaphors is to clearly define what an authentic Dhamma practice looks like. And this is a sutta that gets to very subtle levels of understanding. It's a brilliant sutta. The Buddha addresses those gathered. Friends, there are four types of Dhamma practitioners. There is a type of Dhamma practitioner that enters and remains in mental absorption, or the jhanas, and experiences a certain peaceful awareness release. Meaning, well, peaceful awareness release means they're developing a certain measure of calm. They are mindful of the cessation of self-identification, but even as they are mindful of the cessation of self-identification, their mind is not enraptured with release, with cessation. They do not grow confident or steadfast or well-established in the cessation of self-identification. The line, their mind is not enraptured with release, is a slightly involved way of saying they're clinging. They're hanging on tenaciously to fabricated views, even though at this point in their Dhamma development, they are recognizing it. The Buddha alludes to that, to their level of mental absorption. They've developed the tool of concentration to the point where they're able to recognize fabrications, yet they are clinging to the fabrications. They're going through this process almost grudgingly, like they're doing it for someone else. They're doing it because they think they should do it, their friends are doing it, or they feel like the Buddha is compelling them to do it, or even just a vague idea of a creator God. This would be good for me. This is the right or the moral thing to do, but it's still done grudgingly. There's no joyful engagement. You remember when we talked about the seven factors of awakening, and I mentioned this at other times, joyful engagement with the Dhamma is a primary factor of awakening. And what that means is that we... it's not an extraordinary joy, but we understand what we're doing. We understand that we're doing it, and we have authentic joy because we also have taken true refuge. We understand that a human being has done this. He's left us his Dhamma that we're using, and we are so fortunate to have a well-focused Sangha. That's how you develop joyful engagement in the Dhamma. Without the framework of the Eightfold Path and to add a ninth factor to the Eightfold Path, right practice. Because of right practice, we're able to do that. We're able to develop joyful engagement with the Dhamma. For them, the final cessation of self-identification cannot be expected. The Buddha's not making a prediction that this particular Dhamma practitioner can never ever awaken. He's describing it only at their current state. And that's an important thing, because our minds, rooted in ignorance, will grasp onto that and say, well, if they can't do it, I can't do it. Not seeing clearly what the Buddha is teaching here. At their level of development, they cannot expect complete release. Just as if one were to grasp a branch with hands sticky with rosin, they would cling to the branch. In the same manner, one who remains in mental absorption and experiences a certain peaceful awareness release, but continues to cling to wrong views, is not enraptured with release. In other words, your fabricated views are much more important than actually developing awakening. And this right here is the primary barrier, the primary obstruction, the primary distraction to awakening, isn't it? It's what we all come up against in our Dhamma practice. The sacred cows, the things that we have decided at such a deep level that we're not willing to look at it. But again, this is the Buddha saying you must be willing to look at all of the sacred cows we've created in our own minds. And we, the implication here is that we cannot do that without joyful engagement with the Dhamma. We have to be enraptured with what we're doing, and we should be. They do not grow confident or steadfast or well established in the cessation of self-identification. For them, the final cessation of self-identification cannot be expected. So again, it's a fluid state. It's not a static state, but he's describing four types of Dhamma practitioners in different stages of their development. Then there is a type of Dhamma practitioner that enters and remains in mental absorption, in jhana, and experiences a certain peaceful awareness release. They are mindful of the cessation of self-identification. As they are mindful of the cessation of self-identification, their mind is enraptured with release. One of the themes that I always return to is to be mindful of your Dhamma practice progressing, because in that way, as the Buddha is describing here, by recognizing the fruits of your Dhamma practice, you will naturally grow enraptured with your Dhamma practice. Their mind is enraptured with release. Because we've experienced a measure of release and developing a measure of calm, that gives us the inner poise, the authentic courage, the inner wherewithal to simply continue, because that generates authentic, joyful engagement with the Dhamma. They do grow confident and steadfast and well-established in the cessation of self-identification. For them, the final cessation of self-identification is to be expected. So it's not the culmination of the path, but this Dhamma practitioner, us, can take assurances that the culmination of the path can be expected. Just as if one were to grasp a branch with clean hands, they would not cling to the branch. So the Buddha is saying, just as one with a clean and unfabricated mind, they can no longer cling to fabricated beliefs. They would not cling to the branch. In the same manner, one who engages fully with the Eightfold Path remains in mental absorption and experiences a certain peaceful awareness release. They continue to diminish wrong views, and their mind is enraptured with release, with cessation. They do grow confident and steadfast and well established in the cessation of self-identification. For them, the final cessation of self-identification can be expected. Then there is a type of Dhamma practitioner that enters and remains in mental absorption, in jhana, and experiences a certain peaceful awareness release. They are mindful of breaching ignorance of Four Noble Truths, but their minds are not enraptured with release. In other words, still doing this grudgingly, still doing it as almost that it's a moral imperative that I do this, but I really don't want to do it. They're not enraptured with cessation. They do not grow confident or steadfast or well-established in the cessation of self-identification. For them, the final cessation of self-identification cannot be expected. Just as if there were a long-standing wastewater pool, and during the dry season, a man blocks all inlets and opens all outlets. With inlets blocked and rain falling, the breaching of the wastewater pool would not be expected because there's an outlet for the water. In the same manner, a Dhamma practitioner enters and remains in mental absorption and experiences a certain peaceful awareness release. They are attending to the breaching of ignorance, but they do not grow confident or steadfast or well established in the breaching of ignorance. For them, the breaching of ignorance cannot be expected. So it's really, this is a type of modern Buddhist who may even be engaged in the same practice we are, but their Dhamma practice is simply the fulfillment of an ideological view of what they should be doing. And they have no, as a Buddha is saying, no joyful engagement. It's a surface involvement with the Buddhist Dhamma. That's what he's referring to here. And so the breaching of ignorance cannot be expected. I say this often, the Dhamma is developed through wholehearted engagement with the Dhamma. It doesn't mean that at times there might be doubts or our own aversion to continuing, but we recognize that as a hindrance and we continue. And we understand at that point that overcoming these hindrances is part of the Dhamma, and that encourages our own joyful engagement. We know that it's possible. We know that this doubt or fear or whatever is holding me back in this moment is my own fabrication. It's not something that's lacking in the Dhamma. And so from that understanding, I can then apply the Dhamma to the issue I'm experiencing at the moment and work myself my way through it. Is that clear to everyone? What I'm saying is the Dhamma resolves the issues that the Buddha's teaching here. But that's what he's saying too. When you fully commit to the Dhamma, then you can expect final release from self-identification. The Buddha continues. Then there is a type of Dhamma practitioner that enters and remains in mental absorption and experiences a certain peaceful awareness release. They are mindful of breaching ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And mindful in a sense means not just the direction. Their minds are well established enough and their concentration deep enough that they can actually notice that final culmination of release of all all fabricated views rooted in self-identification. Their minds are enraptured with release. I'm sorry, I left the rest of that sentence out. Their minds are enraptured with release from ignorance. They do grow confident and steadfast and well established in the breaching of ignorance. For them, the final cessation of self-identification can be expected. Just as if there were a long-standing wastewater pool during the rainy season, and a man opens all inlets and blocks all outlets. With inlets open, outlets closed, and rain falling, the breaching of the wastewater pool can be expected. In the same manner, a Dhamma practitioner enters and remains in mental absorption and experiences a certain peaceful awareness release. They are mindful of breaching of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Their minds are enraptured with release from ignorance. In other words, they have established the criteria for actually developing this. It's not just some vague, in the reference to the wastewater pool, it's not just some vague grasping after anything that might seem Buddhist-like or any pop psychology remedy that's flying around today. That would be like opening the inlets and the outlets. There's nothing to hold the knowledge within. It's too open. It's too grasping. It's too modern in the idea that all Buddhist teachings lead to the same thing. That's what the Buddha's talking about here, because that was a prevalent thought during his time. That's all the same thing. Let's just do whatever we feel like doing, and we'll make believe we're actually practicing the Buddha's Dhamma. The Buddha said, no, you can't do it. If you want to be a Dhamma practitioner, you have to actually practice a Dhamma, and it's best done with joyful engagement with a Dhamma that's born of understanding. They do grow confident and steadfast and well established in breaching ignorance. For them, the final cessation of self-identification can be expected. These are the four types of Dhamma practitioners in the world. It's the end of the Buddha Sutta. So we may want to remember each and every one of these practitioners, and you can go back and read it. But that's not all that important. The whole point of this sutta is the importance of joyful engagement with authentic Dhamma without the need to embellish it in any way. And that's what the Buddha's teaching. And it's still such an incredibly relevant sutta 2,600 years ago. So let's go around the room, and why don't we start with Tim. Tim, how are you tonight?
Very well, thank you.
Good to see you.
Yeah, likewise. I don't have much to say except, the sutta is quite to the point, but where I did not get out of it the false Dharma aspect that you seem to be emphasizing. Maybe it's because I didn't read the context. I read your intro, but maybe the context is different. To me, I thought more about the hindrances and the non-acceptance of the Dhamma, you know, the doubt and things of that nature, that keeps me from, or keeps one from that rapture, or to be enraptured in your Dhamma practice. So it's not really important, really what I'm saying, I suppose, but I didn't see it that way. I just saw it for the wrong views that I may have from time to time that keeps me from ignorant and continuing that chain. dependent origination.
That really is the point of this suit. It's not so much false dharmas, although that's a part of almost all of the Buddhist teachings, because like today, the people during his time were exposed to all kinds of different teachings and would bring it into Dhamma practice, and he's referencing that in certain ways. But from a well-focused Dhamma practitioner, it's really the hindrances that we're talking to here. So that it was really great insight to bring that up, Tim. Thank you. Brett, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for the teaching.
My pleasure.
I think I've been different times of my life. I think I've been a different Buddhist, you know, different type of practitioner. Now I'm, you know, my mind might not be as clear, and so I'm working on that. And you know, you probably receive a phone call and some questions about some different things. But I was definitely useful and helpful to hear this tonight. So thanks.
Thank you, but I look forward to talking to you soon. I think that Sarah, way down at the bottom of her screen. How are you, Sarah? There you are.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm one of those kinds.
Which kind?
I'm the kind that I think I take joy in it, but not enough to stay grounded in it. And I've wondered what it would take to kick me into actually the stability of it, because just the times when I've experienced it, even just a little bit, just seasons where I've actually developed it, meditation as a practice in the context of the Eightfold Path.
Well,
it's been very tranquil, and I do wonder how come I don't just stay grounded in it. And then it sounded like something that you were saying and expounding on actually kind of answered that specific question, and my mind had wandered. I had missed it.
Well, so Sarah, the key to continued and effective Dhamma practice is the practice itself. So those times that you've experienced the benefit of it, it's important to recognize that, but also allow that to encourage the next moment of your Dhamma practice. But it does take continued right effort. The sixth factor of the Eightfold Path is there for a reason, to remind us that we actually have to continue with the practice. So the only thing that I would say is holding you back is just that, continued consistent practice. And also recognize when the benefit is there, that where it's coming from. It's not magic. It's from your own efforts within the framework of the Dhamma itself that's developing that. And that helps generate that joyful engagement with the Dhamma. It's good to see you tonight. Lorna, how are you tonight?
Good, thank you.
Good to see you.
Thank you for your teaching, John.
My pleasure.
I think at the bottom of me, I can relate to all of the different conditions of the four types of meditation.
Me too.
You know, you drift out to one, into another. But I think overall, I'm beginning to realize it's really not what's going on in your mind. It's how you attach yourself to what is going on in your mind.
Yes.
Or not attach yourself.
Yep.
That way.
Yep.
I think I'm beginning to sort of realize that more and more. You can't stop the thinking, you can't stop the feelings, and you can't stop the thoughts. But you can begin to control how caught up or not caught up you are in your own thoughts and feelings. Mm-hmm. And realizing that, I realize more and more that it's like the sort of three elements, the perfect storm, if you want, or the perfect stress point or something, is you've got to sort of be thinking about something that you brushed up with in your life, brushed up against in your life at some point, or some thought, or but there's some trigger that you're trying to change, you're not happy with. It was either too big or too small, or the wrong color, or too hot, too cold, or whatever.
Yeah.
But you've brushed up against this situation in your own life at some point. And along comes your thoughts about it, and then along comes your feelings. And when they all kick in and merge and overtake your mind, then your mind, you're just like off and running. You're on the race then. You're just going down, I don't know, a big whirlpool or something. You know, you're just sort of caught up in it, going down a whirlpool. So it's helpful to me to realize that I'm actually thinking about something that I brushed up against in life at some point. When I was a child, or when I was a teenager, or how many years ago it was, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And you can just begin to control your mind and realize that, you know, it's just a lot of thoughts and a lot of feelings about something that you brushed up against in life. And if you can see it that way, it kind of loses its grip or its intensity a little bit, because you kind of just understand that I'm creating a perfect storm of stress in my mind.
Yep.
So, anyway, I don't know how that sort of fits into the sutta you've spoken about tonight, but that's what I've been thinking about, you know, just how we create this storm in our heads of stress. We create it ourselves, and that's how we do it. I think that's what I can work out, that how we do it anyway. Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren. It was a really brilliant insight into the sutta and how it relates to that basic aspect of Dhamma. And your description of the four foundations of mindfulness was just brilliant. You know, feelings and thoughts arising and passing away, and that's all it is. Thank you. Kevin, how are you tonight?
Doing well, John. Thank you. Really appreciate this talk again. I think what I was seeing out of there, the joy of cessation, the joy of release, that's a tough place to find sometimes. And I think this sutta, what I was finding, was sort of a profound or awakened right view. Once we've had the wisdom of Four Noble Truths and understood it, and really experienced cessation, we know better. You know, we don't light ourselves on fire, as we've heard in many suttas, anymore. We know that self-identification and having to establish the self known as anatta in the physical world, or, you know, in our thoughts, is fruitless. And and that comes out of the wisdom of a direct, profound experience with impermanence. You know, that's what we've been talking about for a couple of weeks now. So really appreciate it. Thank you for the structure of it.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for joining us tonight. Trevor, how are you tonight?
Doing well. Thank you, John. Thank you for your teaching. I don't have too much to add. Just a question of clarification. You mentioned this in your talk tonight, the phrase mindful of the cessation of self-identification. Can you repeat for me how you interpret that? Does that mean for you they're aware of the process but haven't tasted it? Or are you seeing that as meaning they have a slight taste of cessation of self-identification, but it hasn't been established?
Boy, good question. Mindfulness, as the Buddha's using it here, is that refined mindfulness we talked about last week, meaning it's resting in a well-concentrated mind and framed by the Eightfold Path. And so that mind is able to understand and actually recognize the release that we're talking about, the release from fabrications. And we talk about that often, and I would bet if I asked you, Trevor, you would say, yes, I've recognized that in me in the past, of recognizing and abandoning fabrications and fabricated views. And so In that way, this sutta is about the importance of recognizing Dhamma practice working for you, recognizing, it's something that I talk about, the Buddha talks about often, recognizing the benefits of Dhamma practice and understanding the things that would detract from your Dhamma practice. So, does that answer your question?
It does. I guess I'll have to spend some more time with this sutta, because that sounds very much like right view when you put it that way. Yeah. But they're saying this type of practitioner basically has that right view, but their mind is not enraptured. And later goes on to say they're basically continuing in wrong view. So I think that's
yes.
The part I'm missing.
So right view is not a static state. It doesn't just describe the awakened state of a human being. Right view is a view that is expressed by joyful engagement with the Dhamma, meaning because we understand it and because I have the right view of what I'm doing, I might not be at the end of the path like the Buddha's talking about here, but the end of the path, the culmination of fully developed right view, can be expected because I'm actually practicing the Dhamma. And I'm practicing it with enthusiasm, with joyful engagement. Another word, it might be an easier word to understand. Joyful engagement can also be called enthusiasm, which the root of that is enthos, which means to be inspired. So joyful engagement could be seen as being inspired by the Dhamma. It's something that it's a real inspiration, isn't it? Because it's something that inspires us to something that we can actually experience. So maybe that's a better way of looking at it.
That helps. Thank you, John.
Yeah, great question, Trevor. Thank you. Julia, how are you tonight?
Hi, John. Very good, thank you. I wrote a couple notes.
Good.
Hopefully I'm correct, because I want to get to the real meaning of this. When I first read this, I really like all the metaphors in here. You know, for me, you know, these type of things really make an impression on my mind.
Mm.
It provides like a, you know, like a visual, tangible way of understanding how you're supposed to engage with the Dhamma.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way I looked at it. And the first Dhamma practitioner I saw as a person that was non-becoming, using the Eightfold Path as for salvific purposes. And that's the way I read the first one, and that's why they had sticky hands, because they were kind of clinging to, using the Eightfold Path kind of like a crutch, you know, just to speed them.
Yeah.
And then,
great insight.
The second, is that correct, John?
Mm-hmm. That's an authentic way to see that.
Yeah, good. Thank God I saw it right. I know, right? Not becoming. the second one I saw as a person being mindful of the jhana was progressing, and so they're not clinging to the fabrications that you know. They're not clinging to fabrications. That's what I should say. And they're using the Dhamma not as a crutch, but as a guide.
Yes.
So they're not clinging to it for salvific purposes. Then when I came to the next one with the pool, the man who's during the dry season is blocks all the inlets and opens all the outlets. I kind of saw this one as an ascetic, a person who kind of starves themselves in order to become enlightened, and so that's not the correct. That's kind of like a calcification instead of allowing the Dhamma to flow through you.
I like that. That's really great insight.
And then the last one I saw, I said, where it says the man opens all inlets and blocks all the outlets. I said, oh, the inlets, point of contact, and the outlets are blocked because we no longer act from wrong view and continue creating more karma by becoming. And so I thought that's what that one must mean. But I'm not exactly sure. That's kind of the way I looked when I read it. That's what the way I saw it.
Well, that is a profound right way to see this. And so the next time we get to the Jambali Sutta, I think I'll ask you to teach it.
No problem. I'll study it hard then. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Julia. How are you, Michael?
Hi, everybody. I didn't even know what to say after Julia read that. I feel like just leaving the room.
I do, too. In fact.
Drop the mic, right? Mic drop. Well, I'll stick around and muddy up the water, so to say. So basically, Julie and I had discussed the sutta a little while ago, and I really enjoyed it quite a bit. But I'm just going to go right to the last example there, and I just like the visual that's created there of the of this this long-standing wastewater pool, and with the outlets blocked and the inlets left open. Okay, and as that fresh water comes in and the water rises, you know, that, like, I kind of like looked at that as is like getting all the, you know, the dirt and the things that gather on the bottom as the waters come in, it's forcing all that, the ignorance, well, so, you know, so to say, up and out and over the top of the well and breaching the walls of the well. And I look at that as like, it must be such like a fantastic liberating release when all that rises up within us and comes out and flows out freely as we, walk the Eightfold Path and, work towards the cessation of ignorance, you know, so. That's all I have on that.
That's great, Michael. I mean, you're getting again to the heart of this. Just the symbolism of a mind rooted in ignorance is like the wastewater pool. That's the inference that the Buddha is teaching. And so that's a mind that is putrefied by its own thinking, right? Isn't it? You know.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's a very, very powerful sutta that is completely useless unless you understand the context of the Buddha's Dhamma. And then we see it as what it really is. It's remarkable in its depth of understanding that it teaches. And it's remarkable the depth of understanding that you're all pulling out of this sutta. I mean, it really is. I don't want to say it's surprising because I've been here for the whole ride along with you. But it's really remarkable that you're seeing, all of you see the fine points in the sutta. So it's great. Jane, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. First of all, I appreciate what everybody said so far. Totally put some new ideas in my mind. What got me the most was the joyful engagement versus the blind following. I think for most of my life, I've been a blind follower. Mm-hmm. You know, things people said I should do, what was good for me. And I believe my Dhamma practice is the first thing in life that I freely chose. I feel mm-hmm. it was my decision and my continuing to practice it because I believe that it will lead to calm. So,
yeah,
being a blind follower and choosing and following.
Yeah, it's such an important point, and you remind me of something. I just published a new article on the website called "Salvation-Free Buddhism," and the subtitle is "Why the Buddha Did Not Teach Religion" or "Why He Abandoned Religion." And the Buddha was very clear in the Aditya Pariyaya Sutta about just that. And it's a rather long article. It's linked on the homepage. But it gets into just what you were talking about, Jane, that it's so easy to grasp onto anything that would take us away from facing the fact that we're ignorant of human reality. And so religions and all those types of things create a very acceptable vehicle for us to do that, because everybody else is doing it, and it's part of the fabric of our society, so who would question it? Well, it was just like that during the Buddha's time, and that's just what he questioned. And in that way, it's not really that we're talking about religions, it's religions as a speculation, because they are, aren't they? Whether they're true or not is not the argument here. They have to be speculated, because no human being has ever experienced heaven or whatever the other culminations of the path are. Nobody can. So the Buddha taught a Dhamma that is to be experienced during a human life. And that relates to that contradicts any fabricated view of self in relation to the world. And it has to be pure, or you never get past that. So thank you, Jane. Hello, Josh. Hold on. How's that? I think you're good. I can't tell. Wait a minute. Josh, can you I can't seem to unmute your mic. Can you do it?
Yeah. Am I unmuted?
There you are. How are you, my friend?
Thanks, John, for the student. Well, I'm still pretty new to this, so when I read the Sutta, my default was kind of to go to the one that isn't so good to describe myself. That I kind of feel like the trekker in Nepal. I can walk the foothills, but I can see Everest in the background. But I don't think I'm ever going to be able to climb Everest. You know, I might enjoy the walk, but I may not get, you know, to where I want to go. I kind of intellectually get all the some of the basic ideas of impermanence and the fact that it, as a human being, because of impermanence, I have suffering, and I also don't get the idea that I have a mistaken idea of myself. And and when I do jhana, if I can get 15 breaths in a row, I consider that a victory.
I would call it that too.
Going somewhere?
I would call it a victory too.
But when I walk around during the day, sometimes I'm walking and I'm thinking, well, I've got this real false ignorance impression of self-reference of everything I do, and I try to say, well, and I intellectually say, stop doing that. I don't own this. It's not me. But I still have the emotional reactions, like, and I don't know where to put them, of being stressed, in spite of the intellectually kind of trying to get to the point where I'm not identifying with myself, but that's where I'm at.
So let me ask you, you said that you may not be able to get to where you want to be. Are you now where you want to be?
Well, God, I'd love to be awakened.
If you can't be awakened in this moment, are you where you want to be? The point that I'm making, Josh, is you are engaged in a practice that will take you where you described, where you want to be. It's kind of the paradox. If you're focused on where you want to be, the Dhamma doesn't work as well. But you're also describing a developing understanding of who you are in relation to the world. That's Dhamma practice. And that every time you take a breath, or I think you said 14 breaths in a row, you have united your mind and your body, and you're learning to keep it there. And that's the secret. That's what we're talking about in this sutta. So none of us know when the cow's going to get us. None of us know when the end is near. Whether you're 79 or 64, or I'm trying to think of who might be the youngest here, it doesn't matter. The next breath might be our last, and that's true for everyone. The only thing every one of us here has in our Sangha tonight is the opportunity to awaken, and that opportunity is present in this moment. It's the same for you as for everyone else. In other words, you're practicing the same Dhamma as everyone else. And I think when you start seeing it that way, you've made incredible progress in a few weeks. Be more mindful of what has developed rather than where you got to go. You know, and again, that's an aspect of being gentle with yourself too. I would say, I know you pretty well as far as the Dhamma is concerned. You are engaging in about 100% effort, and so that has to be enough, isn't it? And you're reaping the benefits of it. So, if for some reason you don't make it in this lifetime, I'll try and catch up to you in the next one. We'll see what we can do about it. I think Ram is still... Where's Ram? Down there. Hello, Ram.
Hello, everybody. The metaphor that the Buddha uses here of the cesspool is even more powerful than it looks like from here. I mean, I've had the good fortune of spending some time in that area, and this is when in the Buddhist time when indoor plumbing was completely unknown. So. Mm. The cesspool was where you brought your chamber pot.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's...
The section of the cesspool describes what it's like, you know, in the hot season. You know, this we haven't had any rain for, months, and it's 100 to 100...
Yeah, I lost you a little bit there, Ram. Your audio cut out. I think it's your connection's a little spotty right now.
Okay.
There you are.
Okay. Hi. So this of the cesspool and how it gets to be such an incredible burden in the hot season, and then when the rains come in the second part, it's just such a wonderful metaphor for all this wrong view being completely washed out. I was also reminded of there is an expression in Tibetan Buddhism of the rain of blessings, and I thought, oh yeah, that fits in here.
Yeah.
When you have the blessings of practicing the Dharma, that's where you get to just scour out and wash out this, like, to the very bottom of this all these false views that you've been dragging around, that have been sitting there festering in the cesspool for all this time.
Yeah. And thank you, Ram. And it's also a perfect metaphor for the world. We don't want to look at it that way, but the difficulties of clinging and being entangled in the world is just that. It is, and so the metaphors are they're very useful, aren't they? Because each of us has been able to apply our own understanding of the Dhamma to this rather short sutta and flesh out so much in it. I mean, it really is remarkable. What a great class. Any other questions or comments on this particular sutta? Okay. Something on my mind, but I can't think of what it is, so I'll probably put it in a newsletter. I did mention that new article. The article has to do... with part of the motivation for the article has to do with my continual reference to religion and New Age ideologies and pop psychology remedies, and it really explains why that's necessary to do it, and where I got the model from. So I would encourage you to read it when you get a chance. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture, gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth. And be mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.